and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and season's greetings. Welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It is my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down the road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and his anecdotes. And as we heard last week, and we'll hear more this week, some real interesting information about what made professional wrestling really work. And without any further ado, let's get right to the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, first I got to wish you Merry Christmas. I know we just had Christmas, but we're recording this right before Christmas. Merry Christmas to you and your family, Ron.
Well, same here. And to all the fans out there that are listening, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. This is a great time of year, and it's a great time to be doing what we're doing tonight. You know, this is fun, and I hope people are going to really enjoy it. And we're going to follow up with what we started last week, and I've been kind of looking forward to it for a whole week just to give them the five steps that are still remaining.
Well, that's what we did last week. We began your list of 10 steps that a wrestling promoter needs to follow to have a successful promotion. And we got through the first five, and now we have five more to go. And a lot of people have been waiting for this. Ron, where do we pick it up? Where are we going to start this week?
Well, I think we're going to start just for those that might not have had the opportunity to hear last week. And those that did, I think maybe it'll just refresh their memory a little bit. I just want to do a quick recap. Let's start with that. And we're going to tackle the steps necessary to finish, you know, building it basically a championship territory. That's kind of what I want to talk about is, how do you create not just a territory, but one that is something special, maybe at the top of all territories. And we're about halfway up that ladder. I've said 10 steps of it. We're about halfway up at the end of the last program. The way to build a successful and a championship territory. Let's go back and climb those first five steps again real quickly. And for those that might have missed, you'll get an opportunity to hear it. It's very difficult thing to accomplish, making your territory not just good territory, but a great territory. Every sports team and every wrestling company, they all have opportunity to compete, but very few ever get far enough to win a championship or be the best. And I'm kind of equating sports with wrestling here in this instance. Last week, I focused on a territory out in many of the world that were going to win the championship by being the best in 1974. I said that my opinion was that Florida was the best territory in the world in 1974, and I gave them the championship for 1974. And I'm kind of going through this today and maybe making analogies with the Florida territory as much as possible, because I was there and a part of it, and have pretty much a great knowledge of it because my family was involved in it as well. In 1972, they started putting together the pieces that made this all happen. And my father threw his hat in the ring, literally, and became a part owner in Florida. The territory obviously then started picking up pace in early 1974, and that's the year I really want to focus on. So very quickly, let's just climb those five steps again. Number one, the first step up is the perfect ownership. Florida, they had done that in the preceding 2 years. Their nucleus was built around Eddie Graham. Brilliant guy. And when my father decides to sell his wrestling company in Georgia, he naturally turns his attention south to his lifelong friend, and that is Eddie Graham, and the territory down there that's always been somewhat successful and continually striving to be the best. But, you know, they're not quite got there, you know, to being really what they're capable of being. So Dad trades his stock in the Georgia territory, all his farms there, his home, in a very unusual swap with his uncle, Lester Welch, for Lester's stock in the Florida territory, his ranch, which is just outside Tampa, and his home on that ranch. And that was the beginning to me of the Florida territory taking that first step in 1972 to move up the ladder of success and build a championship territory. There was a significant difference in Lester and my dad and what they brought to that Florida company. In my dad's case, in Lester's case, let's just talk Lester first. Lester had accomplished many things prior to coming to Florida, but my father had done much more in his lifetime than Lester did at this point. Lester was a fantastic wrestler, known for having a lot of guts and giving all he had in the ring. He also promoted towns for other companies, including my grandfather, Roy Welch, who created, obviously, one of the biggest territories in the world starting way back in the 1930s. The major difference between my dad and Lester was that my dad had worked for someone else. He worked for Roy for 4 years only, and he kind of got his wings a little bit about how to promote, and then he struck out on his own to build his own very successful territories. Dad had traveled the same road as Eddie, and that's how Eddie got to Florida. And it experienced great success, even greater success than Eddie. His success, Dad's, had been repeated over. It happened in the Gulf Coast Wrestling, that first company they built in 1954, another company in Memphis in 1959, in Phoenix, Arizona, 1962, and in Georgia in 1964. All four of those territories had drawn record crowds that still stand today as the biggest crowds ever drawn in those states. Now, Lester's experience is much more limited. He had started in the same part of East Tennessee, working for Roy as my dad did. They both got their starts there. When Dad leaves and goes to Gulf Coast, Lester comes in and takes Dad's spot, promoting the eastern side of Tennessee and running towns up into West Virginia in the early 1950s, we're talking about. And then Lester arrives in Florida in the 60s, mid-60s. He's just a wrestler. But Eddie is so impressed with Lester that he wants him to own part of the territory. He wants to make him a partner. So Eddie's being the biggest stockholder in the company. He sells Lester a portion of the Florida territory. Eddie makes that decision. Obviously, he's based upon the fact that he's running a big company by himself and he needs help. And in the late 60s, the population in Florida is beginning to really boom, and the popularity of the sport is just following along with the population of the state. It's becoming extremely popular as well. So when this trade is made between my father and Lester, in my opinion, that's the first step to building the Florida championship territory into a championship territory. Now Eddie had a partner with as much or more experience than himself, and together those two guys are a combined force. So they have more than 80 years of experience at every level and every part of starting, running, managing, and building a territory. So step number two, they've accomplished step number one, hiring the perfect booker. The Florida territory obviously has been in existence for many years, and they've had many bookers over those years, as all territories did. They've always been a winner at the box office, and as far as I'm aware, they never had a losing year in the Florida territory. That's saying a lot, because some territories go up and down quite a bit. Now that the great minds are involved in decision-making, I feel like that they're seriously looking for a booker, the booker, I'm going to call him, as soon as my dad gets involved in 72. Now, there have been swaps within the bookers several times in the early 70s between Georgia and Florida. Garibaldi and Louis Tillett in particular, both have booked in Georgia. They come to Florida to book. Both had some success, but they're Dad and Eddie are really looking for the best booker in the country. And their focus then goes to Bill Watts, who happens to be in Atlanta during the wrestling war that started in 72. And he has just done a tremendous job. So I think that solidified their concept. They wanted Bill Watts. They wanted him bad enough that they actually went to Jerry Jarrett in Tennessee. He's running the western side of Tennessee, doing a great job over there and doing the booking. And they found a booker for Lester that Lester would agree upon. He agreed to take Jarrett so that Dad and Eddie could bring Bill Watts into Florida. Watts is the guy. I mean, he's going to be perfect for the job. And in my opinion, when Bill Watts crossed the Georgia border, coming into to Florida in January 1974, the Florida territory took its second step toward becoming a championship territory. The third step, real quickly, we're just going to roll through these, recruiting the best wrestlers. When Eddie and Dad hired Bill Watts, they had, in my opinion, automatically taken step three. And Watts is one of the most experienced wrestlers and bookers in the world. He knew more wrestlers, hundreds of them, than probably most people in the business. And he also he knew which ones were good workers and which ones were the best workers. And just as important as that fact is wrestlers knew Watts. And they had he had built confidence where he had been booking. And wrestlers wanted to work for him. So if they were chosen to be one of the elite few that's going to be able to get this run in 1974 in Florida with Watts booking, they knew they were going to likely to make big money. And it was easy for him to get great talent because they all wanted to do it. It's a great place to live, a great place to work. And it's going to explode in 1974. The owners of Florida made the right decision, obviously, when they picked him. And he's going to fill the territory, obviously, with the right wrestlers. And that means they took step three toward the championship territory pretty easily when they got Bill Watts. You know, putting all those wrestlers in a position to make a championship territory, after hiring Watts, it made it really that important step very easy. Watts made the decision who the right wrestlers were going to be, and it was a piece of cake to figure out how to put them in the right spot on the card and match them properly for success. That was easy for him. When you're a booker, you have an innate feeling about what combinations are going to work and which ones will not work. And actually, when I was booking, the crowd sometimes answered this part of the equation about who you want to book with who, because you go out and watch those matches and you hear the response. You can learn a lot more from the actual response from the fans than you can from your own estimation or your own ideas sometimes about what's good and what isn't good. You need to take those fans' choice, I guess is a good word for it, their opinion of how good that match is and how much they want to see that particular combination. And if your combinations don't work as you anticipated, it really doesn't matter when you've got great talent. And great talent overcomes any setback. Great talent is simply that. And it's simply that, great talent. And it's always going to make you money. You can't hardly do anything wrong if you load your territory with great talent. And so here again, this decision at step two to hire Watts, it's accomplished basically step two and three. That one guy did that much for it. Then in step five, It was selling the product. That was step five. And this one's going to shift the responsibility, not so much on what Watt's decisions are as what Eddie and Dad's decisions were as the owners. Now, Eddie's already made some tremendous decisions in Florida as far as how to sell his product and how to sell it to his fans. Eddie was a generous guy, and he worked tirelessly in the community to help those that needed help. He's highly involved in the Florida's Boys Ranch, and that came from his experience working in Amarillo for many years with Dory Sr. And Dory's great friend he is. So both those icons were influenced with the Florida Boys Ranch. All that idea came from the great Cal Farley out there way, way back, who is the originator of Foster Ranches for Homeless Boys. It's a great concept. It's still there today. And Eddie was a part of it, and he was proud to be a part of it. He did a great job with that part of it. He was highly publicized for his philanthropy. Papers covered it, and they got a lot of exposure. And obviously that exposure did not adversely affect on his product. He was selling his product by being the person he was. That's pretty easy to do. That's a wonderful thing to be able to do. Obviously, another way he sold his product was his television show each week. It's the backbone of his business. It was a slick wrestling production, probably the best of its time in the early 1970s. The live matches shot on film from filled up arenas with thousands of people. He was using those on the television long before other promotions and other promoters in the country. And he hired the man who would become, in my opinion, the best commentator for a wrestling product on the planet. That man also is going to become, he's going to make the best out of a lot of territories. He's going to work for other people other than Eddie. And I was lucky enough to be one of those. He worked for me in three territories that I own: Southeastern, the Southern Division out of Pensacola, Continental when we changed the name, and USA Wrestling in my final years in Knoxville in the late 80s. And that guy's name, I think everybody knows by now, is Gordon Solie. So as far as passing the test of being able to sell the product, I mean, when you got a guy like Gordon Solie there, you have grandly accomplished step five.
Well, there it is. Those are the five steps that we went over last week. So we have recapped everything. We have the listeners up to speed to where we are. Let's go to those next five steps, Ron.
Okay. And these are all key to making the wrestling business work. And and number six is putting your key people in the key positions. And this is not just about wrestling. I can relate this to my hockey businesses. I can actually relate it very well to my ADT dealership that I owned in 2000 in Tampa, that became one of the 12th largest in North America for ADT. You've got to be able to recognize who has the skills and where to utilize them in the best position you possibly can. That's critical in making any business work and making it work. If you make those decisions right, everything is easy for you. If you don't, everything is going to be just the opposite and very difficult for you. So this one is based on the ability of the owners. This is up to the owners. The owner is the man that's going to make this decision. Who is the key people here and where should I place them? You don't rely on anybody else to give you their idea on that. You don't even ask for that. That's a decision you make yourself. Because if you make the wrong decisions, it's you that fails. If someone else says, hey, I think so-and-so ought to be here and they ought to be doing that, and you don't make it, then it's someone else's opinion that you may have had your business fail on. So it's very important putting those key people in the key positions. And my father coming on board, obviously, it's kind of like giving Eddie Graham a brain trust to dig into. He now has a tremendously successful partner that can not only offer him fantastic ideas, but he can take over the ship if necessary. Dad can run the whole thing if something were to happen to Eddie. That's very critical and crucial. What happens in Eddie's territory if Eddie had gotten hurt or if Eddie had just disappeared all of a sudden? Who's going to be able to run that thing? So that was a critical decision they made in step one, Eddie taking Dad as a partner. And now we're seeing in step six how critical it may be. It's a key position when a new owner is now placed into a company. There's a lot of other aspects to this. This particular one, putting the right people in the right position, is, I think, very, very important to having success in the future. Obviously, another key position you're going to fill in a wrestling company is your booker. Obviously, I don't need to go into that very much because I spent some time on it last week. But Bill Watts proved unequivocally in his run in Georgia during the Atlanta Wrestling War that he had the ability to draw big money and to even fight a battle in the Atlanta Wrestling War, in which he started out there with his whole group of wrestlers gone, just disappearing from him overnight, made it extremely difficult. And his competition has his wrestlers that he has gotten over. You can't start in a worse position than that. And to be able to take that territory and make it a success in the year between 72 and the end of 73, he did a fantastic job. They picked the right guy, the right booker. Office management. Let's talk for a second about the management of your office in a wrestling company. I don't know. Most fans may have an opinion that, or never thought about it. How many people does it take to run an office, and what are their duties and all that thing? And so there's a lot that goes on in a wrestling office. And in a territory the size of Florida, you've got different divisions. I call them divisions. It's some guy's got the job. He handles this. Another one handles something else. And in the Florida office, the guy that handled the office, he's the top man responsible for what happens. And what happens in that office has a great deal of effect on what's going to happen at the box office and what's going to happen, with your longevity as a business itself. The man at the top in Florida in the office management position is Duke Kiyomuka. And Duke was the man, believe me. He held that position prior to Eddie even coming to Florida. Duke worked for Cowboy Luttrell for many years prior to Eddie ever coming into Florida. And he was a very respected and a great worker. Worked too back in the early days. And he was behind the scenes. Nobody knew Duke Kiyomuka was handling the office of the Florida Wrestling, and he became a huge asset. He used to come into that snake pit office there every day, and what a great guy. He was always so upbeat, and people would almost salute him. They would almost stand to attention. If they worked in that office, he had everybody's attention instantly. He watched everything and everybody. I mean, and everything they do, he seemed like he was everywhere at the same time. So all the office employees, they knew who was in charge, and there was never any argument about it. He always had the ability to offer valuable suggestions. At times, he offered suggestions about stuff going on in the ring. And he had 50 years of experience, and most of that in the ring. And, you know, when Duke, it's kind of like when Duke spoke, it was kind of like the old saying about the company that everybody listened, you know, and they did. Even if it was talking about something he didn't like, something happened on TV or some angle that he saw he didn't like. So that part of the number six is solved pretty well by Duke. Are you familiar with Duke?
I am familiar with him. And of course, for those out there who aren't, they may know him better as the father of Pat Tanaka. And I had always heard that Duke eventually had a minority interest in the company. Is that correct?
I think that's true. And I have to apologize here because I was not a curious person. I never wanted to delve in Dad's business. I never asked who owns what, who is all involved. Obviously, Duke's in that position, and I know that he's not there for without a reason. And it made sense that he was, and I knew that he probably did own a piece of it. And I believe Eddie had a brother named Skippy.
Yeah.
And Skippy was there quite a bit in the Florida office. I don't know what Skippy's actual job was, but I know that that Skippy was seen there quite a bit. So he was involved. I don't know that he owned any piece of it or what that relationship was. And it seems like, you know, Brian, you're so up on things. You probably know more about this ownership relationships than I do, maybe. Now, you know, I know about the wrestling part of it, but this is something I've never dug into, and I didn't feel like it was a question that I should ask. You know, it's a private thing, the ownership of a company in a way to me. And I knew that there was other people involved. I think that when Watts comes as an example, he gets a piece. And I believe Watts and I have talked about it and on the in Studcast number 11 with him. He talked about he was supposed to have gotten a piece of it, and maybe he didn't get the piece. I believe that's what he said, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was it. Let me ask you this, though, Ron. Obviously, as your father would learn, with his father, actually, not every promoter is looking for a partner. Despite how good you do, not every promoter is looking for a partner. It seems like Eddie Graham was always open, with the right guy, to having a minority partner or having another partner. Why do you think that is, and do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing to have multiple partners?
Well, I'll take this, that take me back to Southeastern later on in the future Studcast. We're going to get into that. I'm going to own that company by myself. And I did not want to have a partner. I felt I did not need a partner. But when I split, when I started and we went down and I went down and bought Gulf Coast Wrestling from the Fields brothers, I had two businesses then, and I felt like I'm going to need help. I got to have help now because you can't be two places at one time. And I took on some partners in that Southeastern territory down there. My brother, I got involved. My cousin, Jimmy Golden, I got involved. Another cousin, Roy Lee Welch, I got involved. And Bob Armstrong, which was a great decision. Because Bob is going to, few years down the road, have four fantastic sons that are all great in the ring. So, you know, it is, like you say, it's a tough decision to make. Do you want to try to own it all? And I think a lot of what happened to me in the war for Knoxville that we are about to do, Super Studcast on, it changed my perception of all of it. Then I realized I cannot be in two places at one time, and I realized how horrible it can be for you if something like happened to me in Knoxville in 1979 ever happened to me again. I never wanted that to ever happen again or take any chance of it. I felt like I needed some partners in the South End, and that's why I set it up when we went to Pensacola.
In terms of putting people in key positions, you've discussed the booker, you've discussed office management. What other key positions need key people in them?
Well, this next one, I think, is going to freak people out a little bit. Oddly enough, your referees are an essential part of a territory. And this part of it here really, you know, makes so much sense to me. And I think fans were just going to flip at this one because a referee is a lot more than just the guy in the ring with the zebra stripes on. I mean, he controls so much of what happens in the ring. And especially if you have green wrestlers or inexperienced guys that have not been in that ring before, they get lost so easily. And once you get lost in the match, that match is going to start to stink. And it's up to a referee to sometimes take control of that match, and he can do it very easily. Leo Garibaldi, as an example, Leo Garibaldi was the booker, and Leo used to referee matches in the early 70s. When I started in Florida in 1970, Leo would referee. Occasionally, he would even wrestle back in those days, special times, but he was basically a referee, and he was the booker at the same time. So, you know, he could call a match while it's going on. If he had two green guys in there, he could call the whole damn thing. He'd tell them exactly what to do while it's going on. The fans have no idea. They see the referee talking to you, but they don't have any idea what he's saying to you. So many times, this is an example. Many times when you're down on the mat and you got an opponent in a headlock, let's say, and you don't know what to do, you know, and he would be standing over top of you like he's checking. He'll even reach down, see that you're not choking. And while he's doing that, he says, to get one tackle and take the headlock again. And when he says that, the two guys realize, okay, well, he's calling a spot here. It's called a high spot. Well, you know, so you get up off the mat. If a guy's got a hold of me as an example, and I shoot him in the ropes and he hits me with a tackle, when I get back up, he grabs the headlock and he takes me over back onto the mat. So it just adds a little excitement to the match. It keeps a movement going in the ring that wouldn't be happening ordinarily. That match has potential with two green guys that don't know anything about what they're doing to be a good match if you've got a referee in there that can help them through it. And, you know, that's one example of a high spot and exactly how you can help them through it. And it's just, it's a part of the sport that very few people realize. And, you know, that referee just plays such an important role in the match. I'm going to give you an example here. Leo Garibaldi example, as a matter of fact. And I'd been wrestling for 6 months, maybe. And, you know, I'm getting a little better. I'm wrestling Ronnie Garvin in Lakeland, Florida. And I'll never forget it because of it was one of the better matches I had in that time frame. And you never know when you go to the ring where you're going to have a great match or not. And this particular night, the crowd really gets into it. We spend a long time. I spend quite a bit of time selling. And he's got a hold on me, and he keeps getting a hold. He pulls the hair. He pulls the tight, shoots me out on the floor, drags me in, puts me back in the hole. It went on for probably 20, 25 minutes. I kept fighting it. And then when I came out of it, Leo had told us in the dressing room, gave us the finish. And he says, Garvin's going to beat you and he's going to do such and such. And so, you know, I sell for a long time. I start the big comeback. The crowd pops. They explode. It's much greater than what I anticipated or what Leo anticipated. And the crowd is screaming so loud that Leo is standing next to me at one point here. Now I'm making a comeback. And he says to me, beat him. And I thought I didn't hear him right because he'd already told me, you know, he's going over. And I looked at him. I had to scream. It was so loud that we're face to face, not 6 inches apart. I had to scream. And I said, what? And he said, beat him. And I said, how? And he screamed back at me and he said, it don't make any difference, kid. Just beat him. And I beat him with a small package. I took a small package, 1, 2, 3. The place exploded. But there was an example of a guy being green like I was and just the referee taking over and calling the shot. And what happened is if Ronnie had won that match, it was just a perfect call. Leo's an old veteran. He realized, wow, these kids have got it. They need to finish, and the baby face needs to go over, not the heel. I was wrong. And sometimes you need that type of support in the ring.
It's such a unique perspective for a booker to have, to actually be in the ring and feeling the action, feeling the crowd, as opposed to standing in the back by the curtain or by the locker room door or wherever they would be handing out finishes. I don't know where the booker would be during the whole show, but to be in that ring is such a unique perspective. Beyond that, Ron, what other responsibilities does a referee have?
that, you know, what we just talked is an example, but the most important job that a referee had was not the matches. It was relaying the finishes, especially if you're in a big building that the dressing rooms are separated. He relays the finish to the other dressing room, and the booker responsible for telling him what's going to happen. You know, he said, and that's a difficult, in some territories, that's very simple. You wrestle for Nick Gulas in Nashville. He's got a finish that's 20 seconds long, and anybody can remember it. Anybody can take care of it. If you're wrestling in Florida and you got Eddie Graham, it's in that dressing room, and he decides, I want to give you this finish. If you wrote it down on paper, it's 3 pages long. I mean, it's like, gosh almighty, I remember getting the first finish from Eddie in 1970, and it horrified me. I kept thinking, I'm not going to remember it. I'm going to mess it up. I went to the baby faces. I went to the heels. I said, give it to me again. I mean, it's critical. It's critical to have a referee that is capable of remembering all of it, the intricate parts of the finish, every bit of it, because if it's wrong and he goes over there and he gives them a piece at the end that's incorrect, and it puts a guy in a position during that part of the finish in which he's expecting something to happen, and that doesn't happen and it's totally different, disaster can come. So that's where you get hurt. You're expecting to get a drop kick, and a guy, he clotheslines you. I mean, you know, it's just it's very, very important. So that element of it is, and Florida really had that nailed. I mean, when Leo wasn't there, they had the guy, and he came in the 60s, I suppose. I don't know exactly when this guy started, but he worked all through the early 70s, and he's going to go on to Carolina, and that guy's name is Stu Schwartz. Stu Schwartz was an absolutely flawless. He was flawless at taking finishes. And when he told you something, you could bank on that's exactly what he was told by the booker. Now, the booker has the responsibility, if he's in one dressing room, talking to the referee and saying, here's the finish. The referee conveys it to the other dressing room. But then the booker gives the finish to whoever's dressing room he is, babyface or heel. So that's a critical part of it. And they had the right guy with Stu Schwartz. And, you know, they're really hammering it. The Florida territory at this point in 74, they've got everything working for them. They've got all the people in the right darn places, and they are just grinding away and just kicking butt at putting people where they ought to be. They couldn't do a better job than what they were doing. And then the next phase of it is, to make it all happen, is you got to have local promoters. When you're in a big territory that has a lot of major cities, you can't just say, well, I'm sending TV in there and that's all we need. You've got to have a man there that's on the streets. He's making the radio interviews, and he's going to the newspaper to see that you get a story every once in a while. He's making sure the ads are placed properly. He's getting the posters put out. He's doing all those things that it takes to make it work. And the major markets had to have it. And it's 1974. Florida's got it, man. They have nailed it down. They have the right people in the right places. And just go through some of it just to give fans an idea of who were in some of these towns and who was handling this really extremely important part of the business. Some territories didn't even have this. They did not realize that you need it, you know. And so let's start out in Orlando. Milo Steinborn, he is the man. He is the local promoter in Orlando. He's been there for many, many years. He was a wrestler long before my dad. In fact, first conversation I ever had with Milo, he says, I wrestle your grandfather. And I was like, you're kidding me. And he goes, no, I wrestle your grandfather, Roy. And so, You know, Milo's an old guy. He has great respect. He lives in that community. He is out there promoting and getting his name, getting involved with the community, just like Eddie's doing. And it's a great way to just take your promotion to a whole nother level. And Eddie expected these guys to contribute to their local community. He wanted them to be a part of it. He demanded that they be a part of it. In Jacksonville, you had Don Curtis. And Don Curtis was a fabulous wrestler and a fantastic athlete. And he was a great people person. He had tremendous skills. And he could just really... He had something good to say to you all the time, and he was dangerous. If you came up to Don Curtis and you were a mark and you said anything derogatory or negative about the sport, God help you, man, because he was a tough son of a gun, and he didn't mind putting a sleeper on you, and he was absolutely one of the greatest I ever saw with that hold. I saw him do it to guys in the snake pit on many occasions, and he was quick with it. He didn't have to mess with that very much. He had you down and gone real, real fast. Miami, Chris Dundee. Chris Dundee is the brother of Angelo Dundee, who was a trainer and was in the corner with Muhammad Ali for all of Ali's career. And Chris Dundee, his brother, is the guy responsible for booking a lot of shows in the Miami Beach Auditorium, which was the building that we operated in Florida in 1970 and 71. Later on, 73, 74, we're going to go into the bigger building, the convention center next to the auditorium. But Chris Dundee knows everybody. He has all the connections. Everybody in Miami knows who the hell Chris Dundee is. He's the perfect guy for handling Miami, Tallahassee, Florida. Lester's son, Jackie Welch, his oldest son, got sent there in 1971 when the Florida Territory decided they wanted to own their own building there, which is a fabulous idea for them. They made tremendous money off of it, and they sent Jackie there, who had been a wrestler, and all these guys, except for Chris Dundee, you notice, are wrestlers. They didn't just pick somebody that didn't know anything about the business. They picked guys that knew what the business was all about, and then they taught them. If they didn't know what to do as a promoter, they taught them how to do it. And Jackie Welch did a fabulous job there and ran that building for not just wrestling events. They had concerts. They had all types of things in that building that they had in Tallahassee. Fort Myers had Pat O'Hara, a great old guy, old wrestler from way, way back. And he's in charge of Fort Myers and down in that area. And then you get to me, West Palm Beach. I was lucky enough to get sent there as a real young guy. I had no promotional background, basically, except for growing up in the business. I'd put out cards. I'd set up rings. I'd done it all. But they really had enough confidence in me. They send me to West Palm Beach. And I'm able to make that one of the best drawing all time, one of the best all time drawing markets in Florida. West Palm was just a fantastic town. And all of these guys and all of these cities are expected to promote occasionally spot shows to fill up. If they've got a bunch of wrestlers and they want to run more than one town a night, or just to fill an open date. And you go and then handle all the promotions in those spot shows that are in your area. Tampa, I guess people are wondering who handled Tampa. Well, that's Eddie's baby. And I don't guess I need to say any more about how much attention Tampa got. Eddie's right there and on top of that.
Ron, we will continue with more of the 10 steps, including step 7, coming next. But first, a word about your brand new DVD series, Southeastern and Continental, The Lost Territory.
The world is buzzing about the just-released historic Southeastern and Continental Collector's Edition DVDs. Get the Classic 5-Pack today at tnstud.com. Click Stud Store and take a good look at all five DVDs. Over 12 hours, 67 matches with the incredible Gordon Solie. Many say the best wrestling commentator of all time. Plus bonus footage on all five DVDs of 1970s action and a current-day interview with the Tennessee Stud on each DVD. And the first 200 orders receive two free 8x10 autographed photos of the Fuller Brothers. All this and free shipping too. A $70 value for only $39.99 at tnstud.com. Click Stud Store and ride away with the Armstrongs, Hulk Hogan, Shawn Michaels, Tommy Rich, The Nightmares, Kevin Sullivan, Exotic Adrian Street, Mr. Wrestling 2, and your own piece of wrestling history forever.
There you hear it, the brand new DVD set, Southeastern and Continental, The Lost Territory, available now at tnstud.com. We will have more information about that later in the show, but rest assured, you should check that out right away. But Ron, let's get back to your 10 steps. I believe we're up to step 7.
Yeah, okay. And the step 7 is always keep the momentum moving forward. That don't sound like much, but it's a critical part of it. It's another critical step that many territories fail to ever accomplish this. Most territories have these spurts of growth, but they can't maintain that growth. And so many things factor into this step. The first is attitude. Everyone, and I mean everyone in the territory, has to have an upbeat attitude. Optimism is a must. Nothing stops momentum as fast as one rotten egg thrown in your basket. I mean, you've got to stay on top of that. All the elements that we've talked about are involved in this one. Owners obviously are involved in it. They're at the top, and it goes without saying they're going to watch everybody. The booker, he's got to keep the dressing room happy and his talent enthused, not only about what they're doing, but they need to be enthused about what other guys are doing. They need to take part and feel like it, comfortable with the fact that they are part of a team, kind of, and they want the team to win. And that if you got the booker, that's where he should be, and that's where his head needs to be. It's like being part of a well-oiled machine. And it's the same goal that it takes to become a champion in a sport, and to be a championship territory. You can't get anywhere without this one. If you just let that momentum slide, you're really going to get hurt. Wrestling's a one-man game. Obviously, it's an individual sport, but when you can take those wrestlers and you can put them all on the same page at the same time, that's how you get to having a championship territory. That's how you get to where you really want to be. And Watts is going to make that happen. He's in that dressing room, and it doesn't happen in everybody's dressing room. I can tell you that. I've been in quite a few territories, and you know the ones that have got that momentum and the ones that are going to try to keep it and the ones that don't realize where they're missing the boat. Office staff is detailed oriented. It's the small things in this part of it, in step 7 here, that really make a difference. If you're working with Gordon Solie in the television department, as example, and you go in there on Wednesday mornings, you cut hundreds of interviews. It seems like hundreds of interviews. Guys just start complaining. You're in there 2 or 3 hours doing interview after interview for city after city. And you know, if you want to talk about losing momentum, this is a great example. You cut all these interviews, and then somebody puts these tapes together, and he puts the Miami interviews into the Jacksonville show, and then the Jacksonville interviews into the Miami show. That gets sent out of there on Wednesday night, and on Saturday, those are going to air. You're expecting to go into those two towns and have a great crowd. And you find out then, when you see your house is just pitiful out there, what happened? You're saying to yourself, I went through it one time in Knoxville. You say to yourself, what happened here? And then you find out that's what happened. The interviews for the wrong city got on the wrong tape. And what happens then is Jacksonville goes to hell that week. Miami goes to hell that week. But more importantly, if you're trying to build like Florida was in 1974, to having this championship year, kind of, that they're going to set records, that type of thing, if it had happened, so much momentum would have been lost. It would have been difficult to get back to where you were. You had to make sure and talk to everybody and look at everything as closely as you can, because this is a critical part of your having the success you want to have in building the best territory you can have.
What happened in Southeastern with the tapes?
In Southeastern, I was with a new company that had just started doing production. We were doing the live studios. It was Continental and shooting out of Birmingham. And they went back and did just exactly what I'm talking about. They put the Birmingham interviews on a Knoxville tape and the Knoxville interviews on a Birmingham tape. Well, what happens is the fans are watching the program, and then all of a sudden, instead of seeing their Birmingham card pop up, they get a Knoxville card. And it confuses the hell out of them. They're like, what the hell is? Are they wrestling on Monday? I mean, are they going to have the matches? This is Knoxville's card. Why? So, it's a disastrous thing. It was a terrible experience for me. It only happened once. I guarantee you that. It never happened again. But you never know when something like that can happen. And it just destroys you. If you're trying to be the best you can be, it destroys that momentum to get you there. I'm going to roll on into step eight here, man. And step eight is this sounds so simple, but this is so important. It's pleasing the fans. Now, you know, that sounds like, well, heck, you know, they're pleasing the fans by doing just having the matches. But it's a whole lot more to it. Sounds like a small thing. Believe me, it's a major step in becoming a championship territory. Many things have to happen to make this step, pleasing the fans, work. If you're going to climb the ladder to success, this eighth step is a really important one. One thing right off the bat is you always have to give the fans more than they expect. Never what they expect, or certainly never less than they expect. You always got to give them more than they expect. And that fan experience begins here, and it starts with what happens when they get to the building. When they get in that car and they leave to go to the building, when they get to that building, everything is critical from that point on. Are they going to have an easy time parking in the parking lot? Is it accessible? Is it free? Whatever that part of it may be. Can they buy that ticket and get in the building easily? Are they going to have to stand in a huge long line and go through hell? That's a horrible deal. Can they get home? Out of the building and home and out of the parking lot easily. All those things you have to think about and you have to work toward. Now, back in 74, there are limited advance sales. It's not like today where you can go buy your ticket at wherever, you know, and you never wait in line. There's no walk-up anymore. Back in 1974, the entire crowd was a walk-up. When they start building these massive crowds in 1974 and Dusty Turns and everything is just exploding, buildings have to be prepared for this tremendous walk-up. And someone in the company, and that falls on the local promoters, they got to be responsible. I had that job, and you had to be prepared. You had to get prepared in advance. You had to go spend a lot of time with those building people, and you had to get sometimes additional ticket sellers. You had to get open more entrances to get people in the building quicker. You had to hire more ticket takers if that's going to happen. You got another door, you got to have another ticket taker. You had to support the arena box office. It was whatever they needed. Not getting this done in advance, it pretty much assures that the experience for your fans is not going to be as good as it can be. You think, is that going to hurt me? Well, and that's not that important. The matches are the most important. Matches are the most important. But this is the small things that makes you step above everybody else. And it gets to the, now they've got these sellouts going in 74. It was unbelievable. For 3 months, I never went to a building in which was not only was it full, but sometimes there was more people outside those buildings in 74 than there were inside. And then we're in Florida, so it's hot here. And, you know, in the summertime, it's unbelievable. And the old Tampa Armory and the Orlando building, a lot of the build, Tallahassee is an example. You had to be aware that you wanted to have small intermissions and you wanted to get those people. You wanted your event to be over as quickly as possible. But give them a great matches, great show, but get them out of there so that they did not get overheated to the point they said, I'm not going back anymore. You make sure to do little things like get somebody to go clean the restrooms more often than they normally do. All these little small things that don't sound like much, they're extremely, extremely important. And if you are selling out and if you want to maintain that momentum, and the one I always thought about, the real kicker is you don't want to raise your prices. I mean, you know, that was a lot of discussion between Dad and Eddie during this time frame is, you know, we got such huge demand here, we can go up on our ticket prices. But if they do that, you're not pleasing your fans anymore. And they were smart. They never went up on those ticket prices when they could have charged pretty much what they wanted to charge. And I think they did the right thing by not doing that. So, It's a fine line, and then your booker gets involved. I mean, it's a little bit of a fine line on what kind of matches you have. Did you get too much heat out there, or did they not get enough heat? Was there too much blood in the match, or was there not enough? Are the right people winning and losing? All these things go into this pleasing your fans, and the Florida Territory did a fantastic job in 74. And that helped them take that step number 8 and get a little higher on that ladder. They were headed toward being the best territory in the world.
What's step 9, Ron?
Step 9 is setting attendance records. I mean, you're going to get to that point. If you're going to have one of the best territories in the world, you're going to set attendance records. And you got to take care of your fans. We've talked about that. But the reason setting attendance records is important is because it builds upon itself. Word of mouth is the best advertising of all. These big crowds just build toward even bigger crowds if your venues can hold them. If your venues can't hold them, you know, you could cut back on your advertising a little bit, but you don't jump your prices up there. You know, nothing makes a fan want to see an event more than having a sold-out sign in the ticket window after they've waited in line for 30 minutes and they get to that ticket window and there's a sold out sign there. Nothing gets in their imagination of what they're missing going on inside that building is probably better than them getting in the building to actually see it. And when they walk away, they're going to sell tickets by telling people that, gosh, it was a monstrous crowd. And I couldn't even get in the building. So the fact that thousands of people show up, make it a super event. Everybody wants to be part of something big. And attendance records obviously are made to be broken. And you want to break them if you can. But you don't want to go too far to break them. You don't want to sacrifice your longevity and your success by having a huge, great card that you can't follow. If you do that, then you're going to drop and lose your momentum and you're headed in the wrong direction. I remember having a championship a team in Nashville and Cincinnati when I was in the hockey business, and I never had a championship team, but I won the league championship for drawing money. I had the biggest crowds by far of any team in the league and one of the worst teams for the 5 years I was in it. This Florida territory in 74, they're breaking their records one after another, and they are just kicking butt. And it's a wonderful thing to see and to be a part of. You never get those big crowds out of your mind. And the fact when you drive up to those buildings and you can't get to the back doors, sometimes you can't get three blocks within three blocks of them, because there's thousands of people standing outside that aren't going to get in. And that's what they were doing in 1974.
Well, everything has led up to this, Ron. You've done the 9 steps. The 10th step is left. What is the 10th step?
Well, the 10th step, if you've accomplished all the other steps and you've climbed the ladder, you deserve the prize. And in 1974, the Florida Territory rose to the top of wrestling, in my opinion, and they won the championship territory of the year any place in the world. This last step has its own rewards. I mean, everyone gets to stand on the podium, you know, just like you won a gold medal. The owners, the wrestlers, the booker, the office management, the employees, the local promoters, the television division, from Gordon Solie on down, everyone that had anything to do with getting there, making this happen, you know, and most of all, at the top of all this, the fans are really the true champions. They're the ones that broke these records. They're the ones that supported the efforts to make it happen. And if not for them, not a damn bit of it would have been possible.
1974 certainly is that year for Florida, a championship year for that territory. And of course, everyone who is involved, some have passed like Gordon Solie and Dusty Rhodes, and some are still here like you and the Cowboy, Bill Watts. Everyone involved that I've ever seen do an interview or ever heard or ever spoken to has talked about this specific year. In wrestling, you don't get too many examples of that where people focus on a single year. 1984 Mid-South, people will focus on. 1983 Southeastern, some people will focus on. 1974 Florida is one of those years.
Yeah, and it should be. It deserves to be. Watts did a fabulous job in Mid-South. We had some great years, Continental and Southeastern. Everybody strives to get there, but not everybody makes it to that level. And it was a pleasure, and it's just an honor to be a part of something that big and history. And pure, no way around it, pure wrestling history happened in 1974 in the state of Florida.
Well, we've been delivering a lot of pure wrestling history lately, Ron. And as we wrap things up, I want to remind the listeners that Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy Wildfire Rich and his cousin, Johnny Crash Rich, is now available, as is the just-released special, Studcast Christmas Special, all available at tnstud.com and patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 to access these shows. I want to say something. You know, so many people have talked about the history of Christmas wrestling shows in various territories, from the Carolinas to wherever it may be. You never hear about the history of Southeastern and Continental's Christmas shows. This is a really special show. We usually only do an hour for the rest of the story. We blow well past an hour. Check that out right now. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. If you want to become friends with Ron on Facebook, you can. Go to his page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Of course, you can follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter, at Great Brian Last. And of course, you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Ron, as we're wrapping things up, we got to talk about these DVDs once again. I've been hearing from a lot of the listeners who've been purchasing them, and I know the orders have been coming in and people are raving about them. Anything you want to say once again about your new DVD set, Southeastern and Continental, The Lost Territory?
Well, I'm really proud of them, Brian. I thought that all of these were gone and that they would never be able to be seen in this form. And we were lucky enough to find them in England, of all places. And we've made it available. We're doing it in a 5-pack, which you're going to get 5 DVDs. And this, and it's a collector's edition. So you can start collecting them from the very first one. There's going to be many, many of these 5-packs. And this first one has over 12 hours of actual wrestling matches, 67 matches in all. And tremendous. You just see so many different wrestlers there, and you get a feel for what Southeastern and Continental was all about. You got Gordon Solie on practically every match. It's just, I'm really proud of it. And if you want to order that, it's at It, you can get it on my website at tnstud.com, and you just need to click on Stud Store. You want to go to the Stud Store if you go there. That's tnstud.com. Click the Stud Store. It's the first thing you're going to see. It's $39.99. And for the first 200 orders, we're going to throw in a picture, an 8x10 autograph photo of me and an 8x10 autograph photo of Rob, my brother, for free. So it's like a $70 value now for these first 200 for $39.99. And we're going to pay you shipping. So it's really a tremendous, tremendous opportunity for fans who want to own a piece of history and be able to pull it out and watch it whenever they want. I don't know how you can find a better deal than that.
Ron, speaking of history, where are we going next week?
Next week, we're going to, we've spent 2 weeks here telling about how Florida just racked it up and went to the very top of all territories in the world in 1974. And we're going to continue with that. We're going to pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago. And we're going to go right back into the matches that we're having, and we're building in this time frame toward Dusty turning Dusty babyface. It is one of the most exciting times in the history of wrestling in Florida, and that's where we're going to pick back up next episode.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.